From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories of Sherlock Holmes, Sherlock's brother Mycroft is way past his prime. The great detective complains his brother has no ambition, no energy. In his new novel, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar imagines Mycroft at a different time, at the height of his powers, excited by his gifts of deduction, passionate about public service. He's a young man in love, he's athletic and crafty, and he's off on an exotic adventure to solve a murder mystery. Today in the program, Abdul-Jabbar will be with us to talk about his new book. He'll join us, along with his co-author Anna Waterhouse, to talk about the characters they've conceived, the process of writing the book, and their relationship with Sherlock's older brother. Join us after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about Sherlock Holmes, we don't learn that much about his older brother, Mycroft. We know he works for the British government, and we know he has a powerful intellect. In fact, Sherlock concedes his brother may have the greater powers of observation. But in the Sherlock stories, Mycroft seems to have lost his passion for solving problems and crimes. He's gone soft, physically and mentally. In their new novel, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Anna Waterhouse imagine Mycroft in the days before he became jaded. They imagine him as a young man, crafty and athletic and in love, and of course, off on an adventure to solve a mystery of murder. Today in the program, we're talking about the new book, about Mycroft Holmes, and about the responsibility they must have felt to Conan Doyle's characters. Their book is called Mycroft Holmes, and they're joining us today to talk about it. Since retiring from the NBA in 1989, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has become a New York Times best-selling nonfiction author and a political commentator. He's a contributing columnist for Time magazine and The Washington Post. I should mention, next month, HBO is releasing a documentary on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's career as an athlete and an activist. We'll give you details about that as we go along. And let me also introduce Anna Waterhouse, a screenwriter, script consultant, film producer. She co-authored the book, as I said. They're both joining us today from NPR West in Culver City, California. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Anna Waterhouse, welcome to you both. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you, Doug.
Great. Well, I guess I wanted to begin, and we should point out, Sherlock Holmes doesn't really appear that much in this book, so we'll get that out of the way. But I did want to ask you first, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, I'll put this to you first. Let's talk about how you decided to handle Sherlock Holmes. The Sherlock in your book is, I guess, of course, the Conan Doyle character just earlier. And what's interesting about it is we see him in those formative years. Would you talk a little bit about how you were thinking about how you wanted to – where you wanted Sherlock to fit in the scheme of things?
Well, we felt that we should depict Sherlock in a way that shows how he got motivated, what motivated him to become the world's best consulting detective, and just what the process that he went through, the experiences in his life, and we felt that his older brother probably had a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
So just taking that perspective gave us an angle on the story and the characters that enabled us to use our imaginations and put a good backstory together.
Yeah. I want to come back to there's a really great moment that I want to come back to in the book where it's so much fun to see Mycroft mentoring his younger brother, because Sherlock hasn't quite figured it out yet, and it's really great. We'll come back to that. Let's talk a little bit about Anna Waterhouse, the physicality of the two characters. Mycroft resembles his mother. He's got this dark blonde hair. Sherlock is his father, as you say, all dark lines and angles. Give us a sense of Mycroft's sort of physicality, because it's not, it's fun to see him as a young, sinewy, athletic man. It's not the image we get from the Arthur Conan Doyle books.
No, it isn't. And at the same time, we wanted to be true to who Doyle depicts.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't really put it together. We thought, okay, Doyle is saying that he's, let's say, corpulent, a little heavy by the time he's in his mid-40s, and that he's he doesn't like to move much. Kareem can probably get a whole lot more into that. But so we decided, okay, we want to stay true to that, but at the same time, we don't want a 23-year-old that we can't move around. And
right.
So we started thinking in terms of the old Marlon Brando versus the young Marlon Brando.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, that gave us the image we wanted. And we thought, oh, it's very possible to be very strong, very athletic, very good-looking, and kind of let it go to seed as you know, the years go on. And so that was really our... That was really our model, and I think it worked.
It's fun to see that he keeps those steel gray eyes in the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. That's one thing I noticed, is the young one has those steel gray eyes, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle writes about that too. That's a nice reference, I think, to those earlier books.
Yeah, anything we could have grabbed, anything that Conan Doyle actually said, we used as much as we possibly could.
Mr. Abdul-Jabbar, I wanted to ask you about that idea of physicality. How important was that to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and how are you thinking about this Mycroft who, I mean, there's this reference that in the Sherlock Holmes stories where Sherlock talks about, he says about his brother, there's a suggestion of uncouth physical inertia, like he has this unwieldy frame, like he stopped moving. Would you say something about that idea of physicality in that character?
Well, I think it has to do with just what happens to all of us as we age, and life takes its toll. The various things that happen to us in our lives that are both physical and mental have a toll on us, and eventually it changes who we are and how we approach life. And Mycroft is a prime example of that. Especially as Doyle depicts him.
Yeah.
But I think Doyle also was referring to his own life. You know, he was a very avid cricket player.
Yeah.
He was a bowler. And, you know, as he got older, it became more difficult to pursue that part of his lifestyle. So that would affect his knowledge of some of his characters. And so... I kind of felt that earlier in life, Mycroft had been very active, athletic, learned how to defend himself through boxing. There'll be more about self-defense that we get into in our next story.
Okay.
But the whole idea of how there's a certain progression that happens, especially after you've gotten to a point where you have confidence that you're not going to be physically attacked. And, you know, you kind of calm down the need to be able to defend yourself as actively as a lot of younger men are.
You know, I've read the story of how Arthur Conan Doyle was on this amateur cricket team with other writers, J.M. Barrie among them, who, of course, wrote Peter Pan. And he said that Doyle would know a batsman's weaknesses by the color of mud on his shoes. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because this is what you've done, and this is how you appropriated the stories of Sherlock Holmes in your own athletic career. You did the same thing. He used those powers of observation to get an edge on a competitor.
Well, I would have thought that Doyle would know where the batsman would stand in relationship to the sticks.
Yeah.
The cricket sticks. Would they stand close? Would they stand far away? Would they be the type of person who takes a very compact, short arc swing, or people who let it all hang out and swing with a more robust and longer arm length, longer arch to their swing? There are different means of figuring out how to get people out, more or less like we do here in American baseball. I think the same type of approach to finding the best way to get people out, I think Doyle probably had studied that very intensely and used it in his writing.
Do you think I know you started reading the books of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and I think it was when you were a rookie with the Milwaukee Bucks.
Yes.
And did you have were you as I know those books helped give you a sense of observation, deduction, but did you have some of that? I mean, I'm thinking of the young Sherlock Holmes in your book. Did you have some of the raw talent there, the capacity for focus, and you just needed it to, like a Stradivarius is how you put it, describe it for Sherlock, right? Did you have that when you were a rookie and you just took these stories and started to develop those skills? Does that make sense?
Well, I think I started watching other athletes a little bit earlier. When I was in high school, I had the great privilege of watching Bill Russell's Boston Celtics play. And there was a master strategist and someone who really understood how to win games through strategic and physical excellence. And the Boston Celtics, when Bill Russell played for them, won 8 world championships in a row.
Right.
We won't see that again, ever.
Yeah.
That type of dominance. And I think just to see a great athlete and learn from his dedication and wisdom in the game, I think you can apply it from one discipline to another.
You said something once I wanted to ask you about. You said that Sherlock Holmes was able to see the world in color, in vibrant technicolor, when everyone else saw the world in black and white. Explain what you mean by that, because you seem to apply that in your life.
Well, I think just being able to see the subtleties of human evasiveness at times, and sometimes the need for to be able to speak the truth sometimes overwhelms us. When wiser people would hold their tongue. So just to see what people learn about human nature, I think that really is something that we had to be very sensitive of in every aspect of writing the book, because we had to keep it real. And so the whole need of people to get it right with regard to guilt and innocence in criminal matters is another part of it. And I think that that's Sherlock's strength. That's why everybody is so taken with him and wants Sherlock in their lives. You know, it's too bad that we don't have more police chiefs who are as perceptive and knowledgeable as Sherlock, because they need to get it right.
Yeah. Anna Waterhouse, let me ask you, how much license did you figure you two could take with Conan Doyle's characters, if you know what I mean? I mean, you both have a kind of reverence for those characters, I know. So how far did you figure you could go with them?
Frankly, we didn't want to take any license.
Yeah.
Because we were lucky enough to come up with the idea of doing a pre-story, a prequel.
Right.
And so we wanted every single detail that Conan Doyle ever said about either of the brothers. We utilized as much as we could, and then we never wanted to stray anywhere where people would say, well, wait a minute, how does he get from point A to point B? Now, that means, of course, that we need to write a sequel or two. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, Mycroft can't go from 23 to 44 in one swell swoop,
Right.
But that's the intent was always to honor every single detail that we could glean out of Conan Doyle.
Let's talk about how Mycroft is different from his brother. As you write it in the book, it is stunning how dissimilar they could be. Mycroft, of course, chooses civil service. He wants to serve the crown. Sherlock, as Mycroft puts it, is singularly self-centered. And I guess we get to see the inklings of Sherlock Holmes, those first bits of his sort of antisocial behavior, which is different from his brother. Would you talk about the difference between the two?
Geez, I think Mycroft has a more patient approach and waits for the rest of the group to figure it out and get on board, whereas Sherlock understands, geez, I know what happened, and if I don't act now, if someone doesn't act right now, the culprit is going to get away. So, you know, Sherlock will go and get down and dirty, immerse himself in the environment and figure out what happened and nail the culprit.
Yeah.
Whereas Mycroft looks at the big picture and more or less allows the culprits to expose themselves, and he sets up a situation where they can't escape. And his approach is more big picture and hands off, whereas Sherlock gets right into it and gets right on the street with the criminals and apprehends them. And it's a difference in urgency and a difference in approach that each one of them feels that their approach is the best way to deal with these circumstances.
I think one absolutely what Kareem said is dead on. That's exactly what we were trying to do. And then one other point is that Mycroft has no interest in the singular criminal.
Right.
He signed on to help his government, and that's really where his heart is. He doesn't see it as a game. It's not the games afoot. He doesn't just want to catch one guy. What he wants to do is change the entire spectrum so that that one guy and others like him can't do the crime anymore. To the point that if Mycroft is successful at what he does, Sherlock will have less criminals to go after.
Right.
And
right.
I think, you know, it's funny because Kareem and I really started thinking that maybe fundamentally that's the conflict between these two people, is Mycroft's success means that Sherlock is less successful. Sherlock's success means that Mycroft is less successful.
Wow. So Mycroft has... So he's essentially fueled by a sense of social responsibility, and his brother doesn't really have that.
Right. Mycroft is someone who sees what he's doing. He represents the nation and the national approach to dealing with the criminal element, whereas Sherlock, he gets into it personally. It has to do with individuals, individuals who need help, who need to have something solved, someone rational to figure out what exactly happened to my aunt. Why did she disappear? And Sherlock is good at that.
That's right.
Mycroft Holmes is more willing to be vulnerable than his brother is, too. I mean, he's fallen in love. And he has this carefully laid out conventional plan for his life. It's all very ordered. It's all very structured. And one thing you've talked about is how you wanted to reveal Mycroft, you know, beyond his observational gifts, is sort of this is the ordinary part of his life. Would you talk about that?
Yes. Mycroft is taking the approach and has the values of a proper gentleman.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to try and use his funds and his education to secure a good position within the structure of British society, and that's what he's doing. Sherlock, as we find out later, he doesn't care anything about that. He wants to get into the criminal element, understand them, and defeat them before they can get anything done. And I think we have two radically different approaches to coping with these different elements of British society in the 19th century.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is that Mycroft starts out as an idealist, and through his friendship with Douglas and through his own awareness of the fact that maybe Britain has some skeletons in the closet, he gets more cynical. He gets more Machiavellian in a sense. And we're hoping to get him there. He isn't there yet in book number one.
Right.
But you see a slight change in him already.
Yeah.
But we're hoping to get him there because that's where he ends up in his 40s. And it's important that we see that this is a man who really knows how the world works. And sometimes that isn't really pretty.
The Douglas you referred to is Cyrus Douglas, fascinating character. We'll get to that when we get back from a break. Anna Waterhouse is with us, along with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The novel is called Mycroft Holmes. We should also mention on November 3rd, HBO is premiering a documentary called Minority of One, The Life Story of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. There's information about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Anna Waterhouse. We're talking about their new novel called Mycroft Holmes. It's the story, the prequel, really, to the Sherlock Holmes stories. It's the story of Sherlock's older brother, Mycroft. They're joining us from the studio of NPR West in Culver City, California. I want to give people a sense of what this book reads like. So I want to play a section from the book. This is read by the actor Damian Lynch. And he's terrific, by the way. I guess you always want someone who's good to read your book. And he's able to handle all of it because you keep throwing all these accents at him and he seems to be able to handle them. Let's set this up. Mycroft is helping his brother Sherlock, his younger brother, develop his observational skills. And he's wondering if he'll ever use them wisely or for good. And here's a scene where Mycroft goes to see his brother. He's leaving for Trinidad. We'll get to that plot point a little bit later. This is where the adventure plays out. And he wants his younger brother to figure out why he's come to see him. So Mycroft reminds himself that his younger brother's mind, as we were referencing earlier, is a Stradivarius. He simply needs to pick it up and learn how to play it. And this scene, we should mention, also takes place while they're boxing.
"Now, think of everything," Holmes said. "Odors, clothing, carriage. Good God, why are your eyes darting about? I meant my carriage, Sherlock, how I comport myself. For pity's sake, keep focused." "Odours, yes," Sherlock mused, sniffing the air. "Formaldehyde, either you've been pickling mice, dear brother, or you've had a visit with a physician. You are pale, I take it?" "Never better," Holmes responded tightly. "What else?" "Your hair smells faintly of tobacco, or rather, tobaccos. Surely more than can be smoked by one man, even you. Most likely that means long hours at the tobacconist scheming something up. With your friend Douglas or someone else?" "I shall concede Douglas," Holmes admitted. "Now, put it together." Sherlock frowned, a movement that caused his nose to drop down towards his lips, so that he looked like a perturbed hawk. "It's not very sportsmanlike, this game you play with me since I was a child," he protested, "as you already know the answer." When Holmes did not reply, Sherlock's frown deepened. "Mycroft, can you not simply tell me?" "Oh, for the love of heaven, don't stand around waiting for me to hit you. Throw something, even if it does not land. And no, I will not simply tell you. You need to work it out." Sherlock began to flail about with little conviction. "Very well," he said. "In truth, you seem out of sorts, sad, as if you've lost your wallet." "No, not your wallet. Something closer to your heart, although I strain to imagine what that could be, if not your wallet. And that new travelling coat," he added, pointing his very vulnerable chin in the direction of the hook on which the coat now hung. "Dull, but practical. Bargain price, no doubt, light enough for the tropics." "The tropics, wait. there is something. The tropics and Douglas, whose origins are in Trinidad, and, given Georgiana's family background, yes, something's afoot in Trinidad, and that is precisely where you are heading. Mycroft, you have come to say goodbye.
From Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Anna Waterhouse's book, Mycroft Holmes. And Trinidad is where this adventure plays out. Let's talk a little bit about that. Mr. Abdul-Jabbar, your family comes from Trinidad, of course.
Yes, my family immigrated to America in 1917. And my grandfather took the boat to Mobile, Alabama, and then continued by train to New York City. And that's where my family settled.
You've talked about how knowing the history of your family was important in claiming your own identity. Did that give you a sense of, was that why it was important to set it there?
Yes, for me, absolutely, yeah. Because if it were not for my grandmother and some of the things that she made me pay attention to when I was still a young boy, I don't think I would have become the person that I became. But she told me I had to be proud, and she did not want me to be, in her words, an ignorant wretch. This is very very important issue in my family: education, and discipline and focus.
Let's talk about Cyrus Douglas. You've talked about he was one of those characters that came to you to, this is how you've put it before, fully formed from the gate. Talk about Cyrus Douglas as a character.
I don't know. I'm in love with Cyrus Douglas. so he is really the heart. He's the ethical center of their relationship.
Yeah.
He's a man who has been through a great deal of difficulty and suffering in his own life. But somehow or another, he is able to see something good in Mycroft, something honest about him and true about him. I'm starting to sound like Hemingway here. And and he sees that Mycroft has been put in his path, and so he has to take care of him. And I think it's about as simple as that. Mycroft, on the other hand, sees in Douglas someone who is really the last honest man, in a sense. And we did play very specifically with the idea that at some point or other, Mycroft Holmes is going to co-found the Diogenes Club, and he's going to be in search of an honest man. And so 20 years later, that's going to happen. So at this point, he's found one. What happens to him and what happens to their relationship? And we're just as curious about it as anybody. So.
Yeah, yeah. Not a man given to easy confidences, you say. Fair to say that he's a man you had to earn his respect. He doesn't brook fools easily, it seems, Cyrus.
I think they're both that way. Cyrus has earned his ability to not broker fools gladly. And Mycroft's just arrogant, you know, so. But yeah, he really did come fully formed. And then we had to figure out what to do with him, because I don't think it was ever the intent necessarily to have a black character. And when that black character appeared, then we had to do something with him in 1870.
Right. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, I'm going to ask you this, and it may seem too obvious, but you write about Cyrus as a man who had to learn to survive by making himself all but invisible to the rough-hewn men who would hurt him for sport. He is a skilled martial artist. He has an affection for fine cigars. He's a man whose skin color and stature attracts attention. So I can't help the question, is there part of, what's your affinity for this character? Because it could be asked, is he you in some strange way?
Well, I think that any person of color who is able to arise to prominence here in America goes through some of these processes because, all right, let's say when I was in grade school, I was not expected to do well in school because of the color of my skin. Right. But because of what I just mentioned earlier about my grandmother, I was going to do well in school, and I made the honor roll, and this was seen as being unusual just because I was a black American. And that should not have been the case, but unfortunately, that has been the case. So just the assumptions that we make based on no good evidence, you know, just on the color of someone's skin or their gender or their habits, really causes us to misjudge people and be of a mind where we write people off that we have no reason to write off because of our own biases and prejudices. So we had to realize what that would have been in the late 19th century and address it in the relationship between our two most prominent characters. And I think we dealt with it in a pretty straightforward way. How would someone in Douglas's position be able to run his business and go about his life with a minimal amount of harassment because here he is, a black man in Victorian England, and they were looked upon, I wouldn't say with suspicion, but just with caution and at arm's length. That seemed to be the way that people in England treated people from the various colonies around the world in the British Empire.
Yeah.
But certainly it was easier to come up with Douglas because of Karim, in the sense that Douglas, as we view him, especially as I view him because I can hear Karim speaking, he's a measured guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't waste words. He gets to the point. He will keep his peace sometimes even when other people wouldn't. And in that sense, yes, there's a lot of Karim in Cyrus Douglas, which he probably won't tell you. But
right. I get that. I'm like, maybe Anna's going to come with me on that one. But yeah, I sensed it anyway. I thought it was interesting the way Mycroft deduces the fact that Cyrus has managed to buy a business in Victorian England. And he basically sets up this front. He hires basically Mr. and Mrs. Pennywhistle to pretend like they're the ones, in fact, who own this place. And I love the scene where Mycroft is able to deduce this. It's, again, where he uses his powers of observation. But they're kind of sad, the observations he makes. And one of them is that he noticed that this couple, Mr. and Mrs. Pennywhistle, actually looked Cyrus Douglas in the eyes, which most people wouldn't have done in London in those days to a black man. And I wanted you to talk about that, if you would, both of this. And I guess the essential question is, why is it that Mycroft Holmes isn't a bigot?
Well, I think Mycroft Holmes isn't a bigot because he feels that the best of what England is all about is fair play.
Mm-hmm.
He yeah. believes in it. And he has seen where Douglas has a pretty stable and ongoing business that he's managed to nurture until it's enabling him to live in a pretty nice lifestyle in England. So he Mycroft really feels that England is a place that gives everybody a fair chance, but by knowing Douglas, he sees where that doesn't always take place. And his relationship with Douglas really is something that enables him to see the good and bad of what England is all about. And he's affected by it, and he doesn't ever try to, minimize it. He sees it for what it is, and he admires Douglas all the more for his patience and his ability to survive under trying circumstances.
And I think Kareem's given you the loftier reason. I think there's also the reason that Mycroft loves a good cigar. And
right, that's right.
Douglas can get it for him.
Yeah.
And Mycroft loves a good Armagnac, and Douglas can get it for him. And I think that was really the foundation. We wanted to find something that made sense, that a 23-year-old would be just enamored with this older man who knows about the things that he wants to know all about. And that Douglas spends 20 years learning about the cigars and the cigar business and imparts that to Mycroft, and Mycroft gets it in a matter of weeks. But it's still information that Mycroft really wanted to know at a time way before the internet. So I think Douglas was very valuable to him, and from that value came affection, and from that affection came respect, and so on.
Cyrus has family in Trinidad. And this is, of course, as I mentioned, is where the heart of this adventure really plays out. Anna Waterhouse, give us a sense of the plot, the essential point. We can't say a lot. It's a mystery, after all. We're not going to give away any spoilers here. But people have disappeared. Children are having the blood drained from their bodies. Give us a sense of what's going on in Trinidad that takes Mycroft Holmes there.
Yeah, this started with Kareem's grandmother Venus.
Yeah.
Because I'll let Kareem tell you that part, and then we'll slide back to this part.
Yes, please. I can't wait.
Well, my grandmother sometimes would take care of me and my cousins over the weekend, especially in the summertime. And she'd put us all in the bedroom and wait for us to go to sleep, and sometimes she'd tell us stories. And so she would tell us stories about the Loup Garou and the Jonquenou and some of the different myths and legends of the Caribbean, which many of them started in West Africa and got a little bit more a little bit more flavor in the West Indies. So she would tell us stories about the Loup Garou and how it flew around and it would attack children who didn't act right, and it was kind of like a vampire, and couldn't kill it. The only way to kill it is to find out where it slept and put salt on its where it went to sleep, so that way when it returned for the sunlight hours, it would be killed by the salt that you were able to put in a place where it slept. But she would tell us these scary stories. And also she would tell us about the culture and history of Trinidad and exactly what that was all about. My family was involved in a number of ambitious attempts by black Trinidadians to raise their status. So my grandfather, he was a police constable and was able to travel around the Caribbean and find out a lot about the other islands. And that knowledge really enabled him to figure out a way to come to America and give our family a better opportunity to live in a place where there was financial and economic opportunity and educational opportunities. So that's really what my grandmother was all about telling us to be proud and to go to school and do well and make all of the other members of our family proud that these people were in our family.
So from there, we had a Lugaroo that is a giant blood-sucking mosquito.
Right.
And we wanted to do something with this because it was too good to pass up. And we found out about the Duin, who are the unbaptized children who die, and they are condemned to walk forever on their little backwards feet. So that's a very odd little combination. And apparently the Duin, the little children, call out other children, living children, and to come out and play. And then from there, the Lugaroo do their job. They drain the blood from them. And what Mycroft and Georgiana and Cyrus Douglas were told is that this was happening with some frequency in Trinidad. So none of them believed in the supernatural, but all of them knew that something was up. And so that's what sets them in motion. Georgiana is terrified specifically because her parents are terrified, and she had told them, oh, no, nothing's going on. Don't worry about it. And now she hears again, yes, something's going on. So she feels bad, and she goes off. And Cyrus Douglas and Mycroft Holmes go after her. So that's what starts it.
Anna Waterhouse.
Is that enough?
That's enough. Yeah, don't give away too much. Anna Waterhouse is with us. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, of course, as well. They're co-authors of the new novel, Mycroft Holmes. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Anna Waterhouse and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. We're talking about their new novel, Mycroft Holmes. So I wanted to ask you how you guys got the British sensibility so on. You're not either of you British, but I mean, there are places. St. Giles comes to mind. Terms like tumbling arse over turkey, the accents. What kind of research did you guys have to do to get that part? Because that must have been difficult.
For me, just what I'd read of Charles Dickens really helped me. Charles Dickens and Rudyard Kipling. I read a number of their stories when I was in high school and then through college and stuff. So it really enabled me to understand the mindset and the speech habits. I thought that they were very indicative of you know, what we should be doing.
Well, I don't know if Kareem did Jane Austen too, but I certainly did.
Our first introduction to Mycroft is when he's trying to get the edge on in this wager over the Cambridge and Oxford boat race. I think this was 1870, I guess. Was this an actual race? Was this an actual... I mean, I guess there was, of course, a rivalry between those two. And Kareem, if I understand it right, this particular race kind of interested you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Talked about the actual race. The race of 1870, Cambridge had lost 9 consecutive races and were not expected to do much better. And they turned it around that year, and Cambridge won. So it was a perfect place to put Mycroft, to inject him in there and show how he was really the genius behind everything. Anna figured it out, and it comes across it's very believable when you see what happens. It's how the book opens up, and for me, the whole idea of the British being a very sportsman-like nation. You know, they like to bet, they like to gamble. If you go to London today, there are gambling parlors throughout the city. You can go and legally place a bet in any of these places. It's part of what they're all about. And we wanted Mycroft to be very much into it and understand what it all meant and how it could affect his life.
We also had a British publisher, and Miranda Jewess, who was one of the editors, her husband Rose Crew,
maybe, yeah.
He does something.
Yeah.
And we had it down to the fact that every single player, those were their real names and their real positions.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, the detail was insane, and also because if we hadn't gotten the detail right, somebody in that group of editors at Titan Publishing was just going to pillory us, so we didn't want that to happen. So, yeah, we worked extra hard on that one.
There's a scene in the book where Mycroft is speaking with Cyrus about how he came to be influenced by a physician friend of his father's, by Joseph Bell. I don't know a lot about Joseph Bell, enough to be really intrigued. He's a real character, and he was very much the influence, I guess, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, of Sherlock Holmes for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Would you talk a little bit more about, I don't want to put you on the spot here, about Joseph Bell, but he's a really intriguing character, and his name comes up a couple of times in the book.
Well, Dr. Bell really is the person that Arthur Conan Doyle used to create the Sherlock Holmes character. He was able to look at you and see, you know, look at your clothing, the ash on your clothing, the mud on your shoes, the way that your hat was bent a certain way, little stains and stuff on your luggage, and understand where you'd been that day and what your physical problem was. That was the template for Sherlock Holmes, his incredible powers of observation, and what he was able to do. Arthur Conan Doyle himself, he was an ophthalmologist, and he started writing these stories basically because he didn't have a whole lot of people coming into his ophthalmology office that needed glasses or eye exams, so he started writing these stories, and they ended up taking over his life. But Dr. Bell really was the person who was the model for who we know as Sherlock Holmes, just that keen intellect and the ability just to see huge amount of information in what other people would see as meaningless bits of information that you have on your clothing or about you. It's an amazing ability. And something that all of us wish that we had,
yes.
All of us wish we could, mimic to the highest degree.
Yeah. Could I impose upon you to tell the story of Bob Lanier, the story where you used your own powers of observation to get an edge in a game here?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Bob has, since all of this has gotten out, Bob has contacted me and said that I was... being very underhanded. It was, I had started to read the Sherlock Holmes stories and realized that I did not really gain enough knowledge from the things that were very obvious to me. And we were playing a game in Detroit against the Detroit Pistons. They had a very fine center named Bob Lanier, who you just mentioned. And I heard the ball boys at halftime complaining that they had to go into the locker room and clear it out and air it out because Bob and the coach, whose name was Ray Scott, they were both nicotine fiends, and they would go into the shower and smoke cigarettes at halftime after the team went back out to warm up. And I said, what, they're smoking cigarettes? And the way the ball boys described it was, yeah, they were just like choking them down because they didn't have that much time, and they wanted to get as much nicotine in their system as they could during the halftime break. So I realized that if I could make Bob run a lot more than he was used to in the second half, that he would be in pain and he would be distracted and I would have a definite advantage. And so, I put that to use. And I was able to very often win the day because Bob was in pain and dealing with his own physical issues and didn't have time to focus on me that would have really benefited him.
Hmm. Kareem had his ball boy irregulars.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So I don't want to say something about the writing relationship. One way I've heard it described between you two was that Kareem sort of does story, you do dialogue. I'm sure you share both of those elements, but what is that process like between you two as you're writing?
Well, to begin with, we had a very extensive outline. We had an outline that was nearly 60 pages long.
Wow.
Where every single thing that Kareem thought should be in there, every single thing that I thought should be in there, the editor, the publisher, anybody who had a voice in this thing went into this outline, and then we culled that down into a reasonable story so that we really knew from start to finish where we were going. And then from there, We just started. Kareem had the idea of starting it with the Cambridge-Oxford race, and so I had to do a lot of catching up because I knew nothing. So we really started to hone in on that first chapter, passing it back and forth and back and forth until we were both satisfied. And then we did that with chapter 2 and 3 and so on. Hmm. And that seemed to work for us. Just the idea of passing it back and forth, it helped a lot if one of us had a, you know, brain glitch, to be able to pass it to the next person and say, okay, what do you think? Because I'm not sure this is working, the fight scenes especially, et cetera. And other people do it other ways, but that definitely seemed to work for us. Mm.
In The Adventure of the Greek Interpreter, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's book, Sherlock says of his brother that he has no ambition, no energy, won't go out of his way to verify his own solutions. That's the end point. So I guess, and Anna, you said this earlier, we don't have much time left, but would you say something finally? I mean, that's where the end point, but you're going to sort of figure out how Mycroft gets there, I suppose.
Right. We had little clues already. We have little clues that maybe things are not as, he's not as physically adept as he may be. Little clues that little things are starting to go wrong for him. And obviously we can't get there. We can't all of a sudden bridge a 20-year span. But we're hoping that through emotional disappointment, psychic disappointment, spiritual disappointment, physical disappointment, he gets to the point where he realizes, you know what, I'm better off just sitting in my armchair and I can pretty much run the world from here.
Right.
And by that time, he is in full-on Machiavelli mode. Yeah. But we need to get him there. So
it's Anna Waterhouse and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar with us, co-authors of the new novel, Mycroft Holmes. They joined us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Thank you both very much for the time.
Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We should also mention HBO is premiering the new documentary next month about Kareem Abdul's career and activism. It's called Minority of One. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Lindsay Vickers. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Video West is produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.